Dallas is in the midst of a crisis that's hard to even imagine, involving, as it does, nine-year-old junkies. Drug abuse experts call it a mini-epidemic among young Hispanics snorting a mild but addictive heroin called cheese. After aggressive action by the community, overdoses among these juvenile addicts are dropping, but the drug appears to be as popular as ever. As NPR's John Burnett reports from Dallas.
Cheese heroin is Mexican black tar heroin diluted with over-the-counter sleep medication such as Tylenol PM. Sniffing heroin is not particularly new, but addiction experts say this outbreak in Dallas is unprecedented. Typically, people who inhale heroin are older and they're white. In Dallas, however, users are mostly Latino and they're young, really young.
The reports that we were seeing were pretty striking. Kids as young as 9 or 10 years of age coming to the hospital emergency rooms or detox facilities in acute heroin withdrawal.
Dr. Carlos Tirado is a psychiatry professor and medical director of a drug treatment center in Dallas. He says substance abuse clinics began seeing younger and younger cheese heroin addicts.
We really didn't know what to do with a 9-year-old in opiate withdrawal and what the treatment ramifications of that are. Do you send a 9-year-old to an AA meeting? What do you do with a 9-year-old in terms of keeping them sober once they've developed this problem with chronic drug use?
A more typical user is 17-year-old Lisbeth. She's the daughter of immigrants from Juarez, Mexico, who moved to Dallas to get away from the border's violent drug culture. She attends a public school in North Dallas that has a large Hispanic population, within which, she says, sniffing cheese is commonplace. Wearing a gray hoodie and hoop earrings, she sits on a couch at Phoenix House, a residential treatment center in Dallas. Lisbeth says she started snorting heroin at 14.
I thought that since it was like used as sniffing, I would like try to deny, you know, and now this is just cheese or whatever. It's not as bad as shooting it up.
She says she entered treatment, now for the second time, because she came to hate withdrawal symptoms.
I was tired to feeling like my bones started hurting. I was tired of my headaches, cold sweats and all that. So I told my mom to bring, because I'm already going to be 18 and I don't want to look at myself like being a junkie, you know, like some people I see in the streets, and I don't want to be like them. I want to have a better life.
No one had ever heard of cheese heroin anywhere in the nation before the first case was discovered in Thomas Jefferson High School in August 2005. Since then, Detective Jeremy Libby with the Dallas Independent School District Police Department has arrested and interviewed more than 300 users. Libby learned that cheese is only $1 or $2 a line, cheap enough for a middle schooler's lunch budget. And because cheese heroin is low grade, only 1 to 3% pure heroin, it wears off quickly. Withdrawal sets in, and heavy users require frequent hits.
They say, you know, I'll wake up in the morning and I'm already hurting, so I use some cheese. If I don't use during second period, withdrawal will kick in by third period, then lunch, then sixth period, then immediately after school, then after dinner, then before bed. And the ones that are really bad off are winding up being woken up in the middle of the night by withdrawal sickness.
Though there's some data that heroin inhaling is growing more popular among young Hispanics in a handful of other Texas cities, it's too early to call it a trend. Still, Robert Lubrin, an official at the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, says they're closely watching the situation in Dallas.
The concern is that the people who market these drugs are very savvy, and if there's a profit to be made by moving to another community, we know they'll do that. This is a product that is easily transportable, it is low cost, and it is highly addictive.
In Dallas, things have improved in the past 2.5 years. The county medical examiner reported 8 overdose deaths from cheese heroin alone or in combination with other drugs, but there has not been a death since last July. Police arrests of heroin dealers in schools and neighborhoods are up. Dallas County formed a cheese heroin task force. And there's now an aggressive education program in the schools, which includes this video.
This is a very, very serious thing.
But we need to talk about it, or it will only get worse.
And more of our friends will die. People who are snorting cheese are risking their lives.
Cheese heroin is not as prevalent in the schools as it once was, but parents say it's still rampant in Hispanic immigrant neighborhoods. Directors of local drug treatment centers report steady admissions of young addicts, said the school district detective. This is not a problem we can arrest our way out of. John Burnett, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This year we've been looking at efforts to reinvent high school education. There are innovative schools out there, but they face a challenge, keeping up with innovative students. Innovative schools are trying to add new courses quickly enough to keep up with students' interests. NPR's Larry Abramson reports that a growing number of schools are turning to online education for help.
There are fewer than 400 students at Rappahannock County High School in Washington, Virginia. So when Zach Jackson wanted to take a class in mythology to round out his senior year, he went online.
On Virtual Virginia, every class is a link called Content. And you just choose a module, which is like a chapter.
Virtual Virginia is the online school open to any student in the state.
You study the information. There's a couple different assignments to get to a usually major test at the end of each module.
Zach is sitting in the library and leans over the laptop he's checked out. He has shaggy red hair and is wearing a Lynyrd Skynyrd T-shirt. While much of the class is conducted through online readings, Zach can also connect to a video on mythology conducted by his teacher.
These are like the Olympian gods, and so this is a group of gods, and they include Odin, Thor, and a whole series of other gods.
Of course, for Zach and other kids his age, there's nothing exotic about going online to learn. But statewide efforts like Virtual Virginia now allow hundreds of thousands of students nationwide to take the kinds of unusual courses that make colleges sit up and take notice.
It's probably one of the most interesting classes I've ever taken. I love it.
Next to Zach is Colleen Daly, a cheery blonde who says the course in human geography she's taking online has really lit a spark in her.
I really wanted to do theater, and until I took this class, I was sure that's what I wanted to do, but I might change my major to anthropology.
Most of Virtual Virginia's 3,000 students are enrolled in advanced placement courses. Virtual Virginia lets this public high school offer more AP courses, and that helps Rappahannock County High compete with local private schools, which often use AP courses as a selling point. Principal Robin Puryear says kids have to be self-directed to succeed. Since online courses are self-paced, there's a temptation to procrastinate, and that leads to trouble.
Life interferes. Sports interferes. Just regular social life interferes because they could put it off until the evening, but in the evening they may not be free.
Even though Rappahannock County is less than 2 hours from Washington, D.C., it's rural. There's not a single stoplight in this county of about 7,200 residents. So online courses can open up doors for these students who will be competing with big city kids for spots at Virginia colleges. Now, it's easy to imagine how you teach literature or anthropology online, but what about languages, something that requires daily repetition?
Tong, te, tai, tuo.
In an apartment in Alexandria, Virginia, online teacher Susan Cox plays the sound files her students can access to learn the tricky TS sound in Mandarin Chinese. Some of the instruction is delivered like a traditional class. Everyone plugs in a mic and they have an online meeting.
你们好, and then you respond, 老师好.
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 But these simultaneous classes can be time-consuming, so a lot of the teacher's work is conducted through email and phone calls. Kids can email videos of themselves to Susan Cox, or Kong Lao Shi, as she's known to her students, and that's often where she gets that warm feeling she used to get from classroom interaction.
Oh, this is interesting. She's from Barbados, so she went and found on the internet how to say, I'm from Barbados, so look at this. And then she's got her own picture.
Cox has a master's in Chinese literature, but until last fall, she was teaching history in a regular school because there weren't any jobs in her field. So she jumped when Virtual Virginia offered her the chance to teach Chinese. But she says she did think long and hard about giving up her classroom.
Because I'm a very social person. I did a lot of stuff at my school. I ran the at-risk leadership program at my school. And that was a big thing. I kind of built that up myself. And to walk away from that, and I love the kids.
These statewide programs for high school students are growing fast, but they may not realize their original promise of saving money. The startup costs can be substantial, and it's tough to compare the costs of a virtual school with those of a real school. Online educators say the real payoff is that these virtual schools can help liven up traditional high schools. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
You can find more stories about these innovative schools at npr.org.
Online schooling is finding new uses for technology. Next, we take a look at old tech items that have outlived their usefulness. It's part of our series on stuff, the trash we generate and how much of it we recycle. Americans are using and getting rid of more electronic devices than ever. Blackberries, iPods, inkjet cartridges, digital cameras. So the U.S. Postal Service recently turned mailboxes into recycling bins in some places, helping consumers mail their techno waste to recycling centers. Lots of those gizmos still wind up in the garbage, though. According to Mario Armstrong, he's Morning Edition's tech guru, and he joined us to talk about it. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee. How are you?
Pretty good. Although I'm sorry to say that I threw out a cell phone not long ago and felt awfully bad afterwards. So this is a good conversation to have. Let's start with the basics. How much high-tech trash are we creating these days?
Quite a bit, Renee. And don't worry, you're not the only one in this situation. So in 2005, the EPA estimated that there was about 2.2 million tons of e-waste. And of that 2.2 million, about 80 to 85% of that ends up in landfills, and the other 15 or 20% ends up being recycled.
And the problem there is these electronic machines, gadgets, have a lot of stuff in them that's not so great for the environment.
You're absolutely right. There's still mercury, lead, cadmium, all of these things that can leach into the groundwater, get into our environment through incineration, and that's some of the real problem.
New Jersey passed a law recently requiring consumers to recycle computers and televisions. How about other states? Are they getting into electronics recycling?
Right now, there are about 13 states that are considering what is called producer responsibility laws. This is where manufacturers are being held accountable for the full ownership of the life cycle and would even pay for the collection and recycling of those products.
All right. So, Mario, now that I feel so bad about throwing a cell phone in the trash can, and I really do, let's say my radio is next. Can I recycle it easily?
You know, that's the challenge, because we're at a time where more people are finally realizing, wait a minute, this doesn't feel right to throw these products away. So the answer is yes and no. There are some places that you can go to, but one of the problems that we're seeing is there aren't enough established national recycle programs that are well publicized. And so that's part of a new National Electronics Stewardship Act that's trying to really create this e-waste concept so that people like you wouldn't fall into these problems. But essentially, what you have to do is go to places like mygreenelectronics.org, which is a searchable database of collection centers, hopefully in and around your community or area, where you can properly dispose of consumer electronics.
Mario Armstrong is Morning Edition's tech guru. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Renee.
And you can follow electronics through the recycling process from store to smelter in a video at npr.org. And while you're there, you can also find links to places that recycle your old electronic machines.
Photojournalist Robin Bowman has worked for the prestigious photo agency Magnum and also for People magazine. She has documented the conflicts in Darfur and Bosnia. She's been to dozens of countries and found herself in many difficult situations. For her new book, Robin Bowman did things a little differently. She drove across the United States, covering more than 20,000 miles, and she photographed more than 400 teens. Some of those pictures and some of those teens' words are included in the book called It's Complicated, The American Teenager. Karen Michelle reports.
Robin Bowman spent 4 years driving around the United States photographing teens. She also interviewed them using rudimentary equipment. She asked each of them a set list of questions about family, school, drugs, money, aspirations, and fears. She had to learn to be quiet, not to interrupt.
What is the toughest thing about being a teenager and why, for you?
Dating.
Robin Bowman is talking with Courtney Pazlik in Nashville, Tennessee. In the book, Pazlik is pictured sitting on a sofa wearing a T-shirt and jeans, her hair tucked behind her ears and reaching just past her shoulders. There's a painting on the wall just over her head. She's smiling. Her feet barely reach past the brocade cushions. Pazlik calls herself a little person. She's 17, and she's never had a date.
How about Christmas is born? Mad that they don't want to know me better. That they don't, they look at the outside more than the inside.
To attract the teens, Robin Bowman used various methods. Sometimes friends would suggest kids, but most times it was much more happenstance.
Often I'd be driving down the street and I'd see, you know, a group of four teens, and I would pull over and I'd have to convince them that I was not going to hurt them, that I meant no harm, but that I was working on this project.
She'd get permission from their parents and a signed release, but the photojournalist, used to prepping for a shoot, worked differently this time.
I would photograph first, which worked against everything I had ever learned in my profession. I always knew a lot of information in the past before walking into a shoot. But this, I felt very concerned that I was going to manipulate the image or control these teenagers if I knew too much about them.
Okay, today is March 24th, 2002, and I'm in Bradshaw, West Virginia. And I'm sitting here with
Ray Malheur.
Ray Malheur. And Ray, where are you from?
I'm from Jello, West Virginia.
Jello, West Virginia. And how old are you?
I'm 18 years old.
Ray Malheur is pictured with three friends. As in all of the photographs in the book, the four look straight at the camera. Malheur's hanging near the back of the group, hands on his hips, chin out, looking just a bit confrontational.
As you look ahead in your life, what do you think you'll become? Two-part question. Fantasy. Like something you dreamed about all your life.
I want to live like Nelly.
Who's Nelly?
He's a rapper.
It's a him.
Yes, it's a him. It's a black guy.
Okay.
He owns probably a $1 billion home, and he's got like 20 vehicles, you know, like 8 or 10 PT Cruisers, stretch limos, you know, everything. I'd love to live like that, I'm telling you.
Okay, reality. What do you think you're going to become?
Probably a coal miner.
Do you think that's the closest thing to your reality?
Yes, that's the closest thing right now.
Robin Bowman shot the portraits using a Polaroid camera that gave her both a positive that the kids could see and a negative for later printing. Having that immediate feedback helped, she says, gain the teens' trust. Bowman asked the teens to suggest a location for the shoot and later to show her which photos they preferred. The final decision was hers. Patrick Roberts was 19 and living in Lawrence, Kansas, when Bowman shot him in his favorite alley, a cigarette dangling out of his mouth. Now he's ready to graduate from college, and that picture is on the cover of Bowman's book. Robert says he likes the picture, but feels vulnerable now, reading the words he said then.
The easiest thing about being a teenager is still having a sort of romantic perspective or outlook on the world, not being jaded or disillusioned, and knowing, hoping, that you have time to do what you want and to achieve what you want.
And now?
I still feel that way, but although I'm no longer a teenager, I haven't lost that feeling, and I don't think it's going anywhere, so maybe I was wrong that that's specific to being a teenager. I think you have to work hard, though, not to let yourself forget that feeling of having dreams and aspirations and knowing that there's nothing that can stop you or feeling that way when you're young.
Of course, that's not always true. In Ebony Wilson's photograph, she shot from below, standing on a street corner in the Bronx, New York. There's a sign for a beauty parlor painted on the building behind her to her left. Wearing a parka that slipped off her shoulders, 15-year-old Ebony looks down at the camera, her expression a cipher.
I felt that grown-ups heard what I said, but they did not listen. Like, they just heard me. They didn't listen. They really did not pay attention.
Now Ebony is 20 and the mother of a young son. She feels that people will pay more attention to her words, reading them in a book.
Because when you read, you have no choice but to listen because you can't interrupt. Like when you have a conversation with somebody, they have the chance to interrupt you. But when you read, you hear them no matter what, and it sticks.
The title of the book, It's Complicated, The American Teenager, echoes the stories the teens tell. Ray Malheur, the West Virginian who admired Nelly and his fleet of cars, is now in jail. He stabbed someone. For NPR News, I'm Karen Michelle.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The subprime mortgage and credit crisis has inspired a new version of the old question, what did they know and when did they know it? Specifically, government regulators and the heads of Wall Street banks are being asked if the current turmoil was predictable. Should they have seen what was coming and be prepared for it? Or can they be let off the hook because the financial market crisis, however unfortunate, was unlikely and unforeseeable? Well, NPR's Adam Davidson has the story of one man who says he saw it coming quite clearly, and he can prove it.
If you go to a bookstore, you can find a copy of The Trillion Dollar Meltdown by banker and economic historian Charles Morris. The book lays out in precise detail what went wrong over the past few months in the global financial system. He describes exactly what brought down Bear Stearns, why the U.S. may be headed for recession, and why investors around the world are terrified. But here's the thing. He wrote much of the book last spring, months before the first hint of any problem, back when leading government and finance people were touting the rosiest of financial futures. The book's life began with an email Morris sent in early 2007 to Peter Osnos, the founder of Public Affairs Books.
I think we're heading for the mother of all crashes. It's going to happen in the summer of 2008, I think, which is what I thought at the time.
Right at that same time as that email, February and March of 2007, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke was telling Congress that the U.S. has a Goldilocks economy, just perfect, the right amount of inflation and growth and employment. Financial journalist Larry Kudlow, like many others, talked about the glories of a U.S.-led period of prosperity capitalism. You get the picture. The leading voices in Washington and on Wall Street agreed the economy was going great and would only get greater. So why did this guy, Charles Morris, see things so differently? He was in the perfect position because he's not just a writer. He ran a company that created the software investment banks and hedge funds use to build these new exotic credit instruments. And he saw how they used his software and thought,
this is crazy. I was sure that people weren't keeping track of the trends, so they had proper margins and collateral and so forth.
Morris said by 2007 he had warned every financial professional he knew. Nobody listened then. But we now know that Morris was right. Hedge funds, investment banks, and many other big financial institutions had invested countless billions in brand new forms of debt, things with weird names like synthetic collateralized debt obligation. You don't know what that is? Well, the banks hardly know. They didn't have any way, Morris says, of actually assessing the riskiness of all these new instruments.
Because you couldn't possibly do it. The volume of trading was so huge.
Morris was certainly not the only person to see the credit crisis coming. Some economists and leading investors predicted all of this. But Morris had something they lacked, publisher Peter Osnos.
It's not enough to be right. You also have to be readable.
That was the key. Morris was writing not for the professionals, but for the rest of us. And some might say that even though his book came out so quickly, it's still coming out too late. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
The big drought in the southeast is what's making people and animals thirsty. The drought has entered its third year, and in Georgia, legislators are debating building new reservoirs and other ways to get more water. Spring rains have helped a bit, though they haven't changed the long-term forecast, another hot and dry summer. And that's bad news for horses. Some horse owners have even had to turn in their horses to a rescue operation, as NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
Just outside Atlanta, in the hills of Cherokee County, is the North Wind Equestrian Center, one of the largest horse rescue operations in the southeast. In this valley, on a 50-acre farm, you'll find about two dozen horses grazing peacefully.
Now, isn't that a beautiful sight, seeing all those horses out there? Look at them looking at us. Hey!
Cheryl Flanagan opened this horse rescue in 1998 when she and her husband moved here from Florida. They started with a boarding operation, decided they didn't like it, and began rescuing horses instead. Flanagan shows me around the place. She knows each animal by name. We stopped to meet a large gray quarter horse called Dallas, a victim of the long drought. Dallas would probably have starved to death if Flanagan had not intervened.
He was very, very thin when we got him. And it's a slow process to put the weight back on a horse. We add a fat supplement to their food. The people just couldn't afford to keep him. But a thin horse like that, he could lose 50 to 75 pounds in one night.
Wow.
It's really hard to get that back on. You can't do it in one night. You can't do it in a week. Sometimes it takes a month or two.
Flanagan has about 90 horses on her farm. Most are here because of the drought or because the owners lost their farms. In fact, many people call and beg her to pick up their animals. One extra expense has been the cost of hay. Usually horses graze on grass most of the year, but the drought burned out fields and limited the hay farmers were able to produce. So instead of buying a small amount for 3 months, owners had to purchase extra food for 9 months. Dustin Curtis, who works with his father in the hay business, says another problem is simply finding the hay.
A lot of the old farmers we used to go back to that would have abundance of it, they've done sold theirs and they're hoping to make a good crop this time. I don't know. All we can do is hope for rain.
The price of a square bale has doubled from a year ago to $9 today. With gas prices up, the cost of getting the hay here is also more expensive. Feeding a horse could run as high as $2,000 a year, and many had no trouble keeping a horse or two. Now the animals are being abandoned in fields or left with friends who aren't equipped to care for them.
I don't see grain prices coming down at all. I don't see gas prices coming down. So I think there'll be more horses looking for homes. And they have to go somewhere.
As the horses are rounded up and led into the barn for the evening, they know they're about to get fed and they're excited. Volunteers have mixed together food and vitamin supplements. Each horse finally gets what it needs. A few stay out all night, including one of Flanagan's favorites, a skittish white horse named Trudy, who is also blind. Flanagan brings her a small bucket of food.
Come here, Trudy, this way, sweetie.
Flanagan smiles as she listens to Trudy chewing her oats and hay. Some of the horses will stay here for a short time until their owners can afford to take them back. Others, like Trudy, will remain here permanently. And a few will eventually find new homes. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.